tale as old as fuck. Welcome to the Film Threat Podcast. I am Chris Gore, editor and publisher of FilmThreat.com. I'm joined by Anthony Ray Bench, lead film critic for FilmThreat.com.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, we're actually on our way to the premiere of a film. We're actually going to see the premiere of an indie movie. It's and we'll actually be talking. Hopefully, we'll talk to the director of the film because we'll be seeing the premiere and we'll be attending the after party. So this is one of our another episode of our podcast where we actually get out of the studio, and by studio I mean my kitchen, which is where we've been recording episodes of Film Threat. The Film Threat Podcast. So we're going to be seeing a movie called Prevenge, which is written and directed by Alice Lowe. I saw the trailer. I'm really looking forward to this. I mean, it's basically, it's like a slasher movie with a woman who's pregnant.
I love the concept. I have not seen the trailer, but I read the synopsis.
Yeah, no, it looks really good. It just looks very original take on a genre that we've seen many times before. But before we get into Prevenge, and we hopefully talk to the director. We'll see if we get an opportunity to do that. Anthony and I saw a film the other night that we want to talk about. And we were going to do an entire episode, a Disney Film Threat podcast. And then we thought, fuck that. That's probably not like, if we were going to do a Disney podcast, it would be like all the weird things about Walt Disney.
Yeah.
You know, and just Disney movies in general. I think I don't know if we've had this conversation before about Disney and butts. I think we've talked about it. Okay, so Walt Disney, well, it's interesting. So we saw a screening of Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm. The antithesis of original.
We'll talk about Beauty and the Beast in a moment. But we were on the Disney lot, the Disney studio lot in Burbank, California, where we actually, there's this huge display of the original camera that was used to shoot Snow White.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about the original Snow White was people thought Walt Disney was crazy.
Yep.
When he attempted to make Snow White. Previous to this, Walt Disney Studios had only made animated shorts. They had never made an animated feature film. So this was Disney's first attempt at a feature film. And while we were on the Disney lot in Burbank, there is a display where they have the original camera rig that was used to shoot Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and I mean it's huge, it's enormous, and like George Lucas, Walt Disney had to invent a lot of technology in order to make strides with regard to entertainment.
We looks like dwarves standing next to it.
Yeah, it's
that's
huge.
How big it is.
It's huge. I mean, it's as large as a studio apartment in New York City.
Mm.
And it's this weird rig that has like a camera and then these plates, and you kind of see how they had to crudely in the 30s make animated films.
Yep.
So, but people called Snow White Disney's folly as he was making it at the time, but then it turned out to be a huge success.
It saved them.
It saved the studio, nearly bankrupted Walt Disney Studios, but saved them and proved that audiences are willing to sit through an entire feature length animated film.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all fascinating and well and good. But okay, back to butts. There's a lot of weird hidden things in Disney movies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And one of the things you could look on this is, and also if you hear traffic noise, it's because we're racing through traffic to see this film.
You're not going to.
You're not no. Really? Yeah. The microphones are this good?
Yeah.
Okay, good. But traffic in LA is not so good.
Yeah.
So there you go. But if you haven't hear any weird noises, it's because we're in traffic in LA.
We're literally doing this in my car.
Right. Yeah, no, we are. Yeah. Yes, we're in Anthony's car on our way to see Prevenge at Cinefamily on Fairfax. If you've ever been to the silent movie theater, Cinefamily puts on amazing events. So, and they have this little courtyard area in the back that they do receptions. So I'm anxious to go there and meet the director, Alice Lowe. So this is the thing. So Disney made these animated shorts, and Walt Disney noticed that whenever he put butts in an animated film, little kids would giggle. Now, when I say butts, I mean like the butts of like animal, furry animal characters.
Yeah.
Little cute furry animal characters. Very innocent, very innocent. But whenever there's butts, they would just giggle and laugh. What the effect that that had is so all the little children are giggling and laughing, it then made the entire audience laugh.
So, I wonder if that's why Mickey Mouse has a big badonkadonk.
Well, if you look it up, you actually, if you Google Walt Disney butts, you will see. I'm sure someone on YouTube has made a montage of this throughout all the early. I'm talking about the early Walt Disney animated features. Mm-hmm. Bambi in particular has a lot of butt scenes. Pinocchio does as well. So does Snow White and early animated Walt Disney shorts. And it was sort of like his, he knew that he needed a reaction from audiences, right? For a certain amount of time to go by, you need to have giggles, big laughs. You need to keep the audience entertained. And that appealed to very young children. So that was something that he did consistently in this film. Now you cannot watch, I'm telling you, after knowing this, Walt Disney and Butts, and I learned this from John Crisfalusi. The mad genius behind Ren and Stimpy is the person who gave me. I feel like I took a master class in animation just by being around John when I knew him back in the early 90s at the height of Ren and Stimpy's fame. But that's a story for another time entirely. We're here. We originally were starting this podcast. We're gonna talk about Beauty and the Beast. We were gonna do an entire Disney episode, which we scrapped because. Why the fuck would Film Threat do a Walt Disney? We're supposed to be talking about independent film, talking to independent filmmakers, and we're going to spin off very soon. We're going to be spinning off a completely different podcast that will address tentpole major Hollywood releases in a completely different way. I'm excited to announce. Should we even talk about? We're spinning off in a separate podcast called Blockbuster Busters.
Yep. And I'm excited for it.
I can tell you're excited by the monotone that you just delivered.
I'm
really
person.
Excited. Wow, you and Eeyore get so excited sometimes.
Eeyore's
I can't believe.
My favorite.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, no, I'm not an Eeyore guy. I'm more of a Tigger guy.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm kind of, that makes sense.
Yeah,
right?
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, so you're Eeyore. Sense. I'm Tigger.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, so, I love the premise. Like, tell the people about the premise.
Okay, well, basically, we're just going to go see big blockbuster movies the day they open, and we're going to, because that episode that we did that was set at the Arclight, where we did it like at the, that was so successful, we're just going to start doing those. So we're going to go see the movies on, we're gonna paying to see the movies on opening night, and then we're just going to talk about them after. So that's Blockbuster Busters. It's spinning off because we have other podcasts that we're going to be doing as part of the Film Threat Podcast Network. That's not the only one. There'll be some other ones upcoming, but Blockbuster Busters is the first one that I'm excited to announce. In fact, you know what? Let's just give them a taste. Here's the Blockbuster Busters theme song.
Blockbuster Busters. Blockbuster Busters. Blockbuster Busters. Blockbuster Busters. Blockbuster Busters.
I like the theme song for Blockbuster Busters.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. Okay, so that's spinning off.
I'm sorry. It is awesome.
So, yeah, you could do that more monotone. Okay, so that'll be spinning off in the next couple weeks, and we really want to focus Film Threat on just sort of alternative takes on Hollywood stuff, talking about indie movies and film festivals, and interviewing indie filmmakers. We hope to get to do that tonight, although I was not promised by the publicist for Prevenge that I would get to talk to Alice.
So we're doing it guerrilla style.
We're gonna go in with our microphones. We're gonna do it guerrilla style, and we'll see if she talks to us for 10 minutes or so at the after party. There is a post screening Q&A. So there you go. And you know what? It wouldn't be Los Angeles in traffic if we didn't hear police sirens.
Yeah, that's probably being picked up.
It is going to be picked up. Okay, probably. That's cool. All right. So now you know about Disney and butts. There's a lot of other there are a lot of other things like the original release of Little Mermaid when Little Mermaid came out in the original VHS release
yes.
In the clamshell there was a penis that was painted onto. Now, the myth was they snuck it on. Here is the truth behind that, because I know that we actually did a story in Film Threat, the print magazine, that's how long ago this is, about the Little Mermaid penis thing. The guy who painted that happened to be gay, and he did paint it, and it was he was not intended. He was horrified. He was embarrassed. He was, but if you look this up, it wasn't they snuck it on. It was literally something that was just completely subconscious. So it wasn't anything, nothing perverse was intended.
That penis had a vein. Are you sure?
I'm absolutely, look it up, look it up. It's true. It's okay. True. Everybody thought, oh, they snuck it in. It's like, no, it was just a guy being lazy at work. His dreams were filled with, like, I don't know, popsicles, hot dogs, and, you know, these, the pinnacle of a tower.
I especially like the scene in The Little Mermaid where the priest's conducting the marriage ceremony between Ursula in disguise and Prince Eric pops a boner.
Yes. Well, yeah. There we are then. So
Disney, everybody.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool. Well, you know what? Maybe we should do a Disney episode eventually. Maybe it'll be for another podcast. Maybe it'll be for Blockbuster Busters. But right now we're talking about Beauty and the Beast, which your review is going to be up on the website. I don't know. I think it's actually already on the website by the time that this podcast posts. But let's talk about Beauty and the Beast. We went into it. Can I just say this? I was pumped.
Okay.
I was pumped because that, I don't know, just I got chills watching those initial trailers. I went into it. I was excited. You know, I'm kind of there. I you know, as much as I like, you know, edgy indie films, I'm kind of a sap, a romantic sap. I can be a romantic sap at times. I have been known. So and Beauty and the Beast was really a turning point in the sort of reinvigoration of Disney animation led by Jeffrey Katzenberg at the time. This is in the late 80s, early 90s, when he kind of righted this ship and said, we've got to make great animated films. So this was the reinvigoration. Beauty and the Beast was the beginnings of that.
Yeah, before that, you had films like The Black Cauldron that kind of skewed a little bit darker, and The Rescuers, right. That's a dark film. I wonder if we would have been better off with films like that. Like, with filmmakers like Tim Burton and Don Bluth still a part of the Disney company kind of steering the ship, it would have been different.
Well, I think it's variety. I mean, basically what ended up, I mean, you know, look, when Jeffrey Katzenberg took over, they're basically musicals.
Yeah.
I mean, all of these Disney animated features ended up being musicals. I mean, music is a big part of Disney, you know, feature films, but it really became like talk more in the Broadway play sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these were translatable and have been to Broadway plays
with the big music numbers and
correct. Yeah. Yeah. And the set pieces mm-hmm. and duets and all that stuff. So that became kind of formulaic and tired also after a time, but the original Beauty and the Beast animated feature is a classic.
Yeah.
Let's get to the movie. Let's get to the movie. Because I went into it, look, I wasn't pumped. I was like excited. Like, look, I just want to see good movies. I'm hopeful and optimistic about movies that I go see. I go in wanting to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you this: it was a screening on the lot with there were a lot of kids with families. You know, there were a lot of like. Well, obviously, they were the kids, their parents of the kids were there taking mm-hmm. them to see this movie. So it was a mixed audience of children and adults. And I don't want to say it's a shot for shot. The live action Beauty and the Beast is shot for shot remake of Beauty and the Beast, but sure is. It feels beat for beat. They did add some new things. They excised some things from the cartoon, but it pretty much follows all of the main story beats. And in general, the movie just felt flat for a number of reasons. One, I think that the casting was off for a lot of characters, including the guy who played Gaston.
Okay, I disagree with you. I think Luke Evans did a really good job.
I think he was miscast because he was a little too old. And then he just sort of lacked the charm. And this is the thing, and you just told me this yesterday as we were leaving the screening, that the guy, like, I think that the best Gaston live action is the guy who's in all those YouTube videos, you know, who's doing, like, the push-up contest with the little girl, who's, like, very charming, and you see these YouTube videos of the guy who plays Gaston at Disneyland is incredible. And I'm thinking, like, I'm sure they would have gotten a charming guy like that, who's just sort of a himbo. He's completely, really not self-aware, very narcissistic. But Luke Evans. Luke Evans, I just thought he was creepy. I mean, like a creepy bully.
Okay.
It just didn't work for me. And you were telling me that the guy who played Gaston, who's at the Disneyland parks.
Yeah, in the early YouTube videos, he died in a firework accident. He was holding a firework, and it went off, and it killed him. He was drunk.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, on July 4th, I believe.
Oh, wow.
This was a couple of years ago, and there are more YouTube videos featuring the Gaston character, but it's a different Gaston?
A
different cast member playing the role.
Wow. So I felt that there's some miscastings. It's also not the only miscasting, in my opinion.
No. Emma Watson was the biggest one for me.
Yeah, she didn't. You know what? It's a good thing she didn't get cast in La La Land.
Because she cannot sing for shit.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Well, Let's go on. Tell me what you thought of Emma's performance.
I thought she was boring. I thought that it was weird that everybody kind of tried to do a really bad French accent. And she did a British accent.
But that's true. That's true in a lot of movies where it's like the accent doesn't really match. Like in Roman films,
mm-hmm.
in so many films portraying Romans.
They're all British, yeah.
They're all British, exactly. Shouldn't they be speaking in some sort of Latin or, you know, Italian?
Yeah, but it was just weird because everybody else was trying this French thing. And she was the main character and did not, like, it. Even attempted.
A lot of the humor fell flat. It was weird.
Yeah.
So we're seeing this audience that is, they've loaded the deck, right? It's children, it's parents with
their
children.
Did you notice the lady sitting to my left fell asleep?
Oh, no, I didn't notice that.
Oh, she clonked out.
Oh, wow. So, but like, what was weird was, this should have been applause lines, should have been huge laughs. The movie would stop almost as if it was holding for audience reaction. And The audience here, it wasn't, look, we weren't in a screening room with a bunch of stuffy critics, which is what most of these early screenings are. This was packed with people predisposed to like, I mean, sort of spotty. There were a couple critics there. You know, I saw Drew McWeeny was at the screening that we were at. So, but it was mostly kids and, you know, it was kids, families, you know, so. There should have been a big reaction. There was not. The digital effects, in particular the Beast, not only digital effects, like just were sort of mixed, because these characters that are sort of anthropomorphized, you know, candle, teacup, you've got Chip as the teacup, the teacups
and the teapots were horrifying.
Yeah,
they looked like they were out of a horror movie.
Yeah, it's weird, and it's not like fanciful like in the old Sid and Marty Krofft, where you've got these like live action. They almost should have gone that route rather than digital. But the other thing that did not work, in particular, which is a huge and this is awful. This is unacceptable. Emma Watson. If you look closely, you could see the green line around her. I haven't seen a line around a live-action character against a clearly digital background since really bad science fiction films from the 80s. Mm. You could see a green line around her. Unacceptable. Truly unacceptable, right?
I didn't notice this, but
I did.
If I was interested in catching another showing, which I'm not,
yeah.
I would look out for it.
Yeah, I was so bored. Mm-hmm. I was just, you know, picking it apart. But the thing that didn't work that should have was the character of the Beast.
Yeah.
The character of the Beast was not engaging. Was it an actor in a suit where they digitally put the face on, or was it all digital? Because the thing that looked terrible was the clothing on the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
Clothing on the Beast looked fake. It looked like Emma Watson had been transported into a video game. It just looked like she was inside of a video game. It didn't look, and the reactions of the Beast, it had like these human-ish eyes, but this clearly digital face.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. The effects were garbage. Now, you didn't care for the actor or voice actor.
No, I didn't care. I didn't care for the actor who played the Beast, the guy from Legion.
Yeah. I liked him. Dan Stevens is his name.
Yeah.
I thought he did a good job.
He completely lacked charm. Really? But I mean, it could have been also the fact that you really only see him obviously at the end. There's just the other thing that's also kind of boring.
Oh, no, no, I'm not talking about the actual, like, prince as the human character. I'm talking about as the beast, like the character of the beast. I liked. I thought they did good with that.
Wrong.
Okay.
Look, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying it just didn't. For me, it was so digital that I just didn't feel engaged with the character. It felt false to me. It just rang completely false. Yeah. So, and that's kind of a critical part. The other thing that I think didn't work is it's almost like, do you remember when Gus Van Sant did that shot-for-shot remake of Psycho?
Yes.
Okay, now, this Beauty and the Beast live action is not shot-for-shot of the original Beauty and the Beast Park cartoon, but it is beat-for-beat the same things happen. So I already know what happens.
Yeah.
And so there was no anticipation. There was no suspense. We know she's going to, we know everything's going to be righted by the end. Mm-hmm. It was boring. And it was slow. The pacing was off.
Yeah. The parts that they added were just superfluous.
And
it reminded me of Batman v Superman, the ultimate cut, where it's like, all right, you're explaining certain aspects of the film, but you're doing it in a way where I don't care. It's not adding anything to the experience.
Now here's another thing, and this is going to be slightly controversial for me to bring up, but you know what? Fuck it, I'm going to bring it up. The cast is diverse, and by diverse I mean it's white people with smatterings of black people, right? So, but here's what annoys me about that. First of all, I am all for diversity. We live in a very diverse, ethnically diverse culture. I mean, we just do, especially We just do. That's just reality now, right? But did, in France at the time, to be historically accurate, were black people part of high society?
I don't know personally.
I don't know. But also, like, if you're going to be diverse, why not go full on diverse? Because there were no Asian people, like zero Asian people. There weren't any Hispanic people. There were zero Middle Eastern peoples.
Yep.
All there were was white people, and there were a couple black people in indefinitely token roles.
Yeah, that didn't really add anything. Like the bookseller.
Yeah.
They would cut to him every once in a while, and he didn't have any additional lines aside from that itty-bitty bit in the beginning.
It was like Disney saying, look at us, we're socially progressive. But if you're going to be socially progressive, where are the Asian characters? I mean, if you're going to do it, then go all the way and actually have it so it's so mixed, it just doesn't matter. But because it was like all white with a couple of black characters that are actually not pivotal at all to the story or the plot at all. So it just seems very, it felt pandering to me, and it didn't feel like a true diversity because they weren't mixing in other ethnicities. I'm sorry, that sounds weird. If you're going to go diverse, go full diverse instead of that. The way that they handled it, I thought was pandering, and it didn't work.
I agree.
Okay, yeah. So we're walking out of the screening, and it's one of the other thing that came up about this. Just because we got to put a button on this, because we got to get to a movie, right? Mm-hmm. We got to get to this premiere. So, I just think there are some things in the movie that just fell flat for a number of reasons that are accurate to the cartoon, and I think the reason is that there are things that you can get away with in animation that you cannot, that just don't work in live action. They just don't work. And the best example of this is any episode of The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
Or any episode of Family Guy, or any episode of South Park. If you took those animated shows and you took the same script for a Simpsons, a South Park, a Family Guy, and you did those live action, people would be offended.
Yeah.
They would be horrified. There are there's commentary in all those shows about religion, drugs, culture, human rights, that you can get away with in animation because it's just animation, it's fanciful. But when you try to deal with some of those issues in live action, they don't really work. Now, I'm not saying Beauty and the Beast was grappling with any major social issues, but Beauty and the Beast had some things in it that, like, were true to the animated film that just felt weird and off being in a live action movie.
Yeah. You know, a perfect example of that is the opening number, the Bonjour, I believe. No, I think the song is called Belle. Mm-hmm. In the animated film, it's really interesting because Belle kind of walks through the city with her nose in a book. And the song is literally about how she doesn't fit in because her head is in the clouds. She's a bookworm. And it's a great visual. In the live action film, she's just walking around looking at everybody, singing about her. And it's just weird.
Yeah, yeah.
The cinematography was also garbage, I think.
Yeah, it also could have been. We were in a smaller than usual screening room. That could have also been part of it. But yeah, they're just things that just didn't. I mean, we've already accepted that in musicals, people sing their inner monologue, right? They're just singing. They're expressing. That's their way of expressing it. So we accept that. But just knowing the animated film so well, it did not. It didn't work. I'm really, really interested to see what Jon Favreau does with Lion King. Right, that's coming.
I'm not interested.
It'll be. I mean, it's. It might as well be a Pixar movie, right?
Yeah.
At this stage.
You know what? If Disney wants to remake these movies, I would rather them do the thing they did with Maleficent, where they kind of tell the stories from a different point of view. I hated Maleficent, but at least it was different.
Right.
There was too much of the same thing in this version, and there was too much of the same thing in Cinderella. It just. Why? Why are you doing this?
You know, this is weird. We're in a car going to the screening of this, an early screening of this movie, and we're talking about Cinderella and princesses and what, you know, come on. This is ridiculous.
One more thing I want to say about it, and then we can move on. The Josh Gad thing.
Oh, Josh Gad. Yeah, being gay. Right. Yeah. He's gay. First of all, I think he's no more gay than C-3PO is in Star Wars, right?
I agree, yeah.
He's just sort of a complainer, and he actually has some of the, what's weird is just how not funny he is.
Yeah, I'm over Josh Gad.
Yeah, but like at the end, there's a really quick shot of him dancing with a guy. It's no more gay than Bugs Bunny is when Bugs Bunny dresses in drag. It's stupid. So for people to be up in arms over Disney's first gay character, it's just, you know what?
But that's Disney's fault. They're the ones that made a big deal out of it. Honestly, if I would watch the movie, I would have been like, yeah, you know, he's kind of, feminine. But he was that way in the original cartoon. It's just the character.
Well, you know what's really gay?
What?
Talking about Disney movies for 30 minutes before we go to an indie film called Prevenge. I think we need to end this conversation. We're off to go see Prevenge. We will we'll take a quick break. What am I taking a quick break? We're not taking a break.
No.
We're just going to go see the movie. All right. We'll talk about Prevenge in just a sec. So we just got out of the screening of Prevenge, directed by Alice Lowe. And I have to say, the Q&A was awesome. The movie was amazing. And it was also like, it wasn't as exploitative as I thought it would be.
Yeah, it kind of felt like it was in the vein of American Psycho a little bit.
Oh, wow. I totally didn't think of that.
Really?
Well, because of the period. I mean, I think of American Psycho as a period piece.
Ah, okay. I just, going in, I thought it was going to be kind of like a B-movie, slasher type thing. And it was really artistic.
But it had much deeper layers than that.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
And by
shot.
Deeper, I mean, it got really, there's a couple scenes that are pretty gross.
Yeah, made me feel really uncomfortable, to be honest. But I love that in horror.
Yeah.
I love that in horror. It's almost, as a horror fan, you kind of get jaded sometimes. Like, I've seen everything. Nothing,
but,
you know.
But we've never seen anything like this.
Yeah.
Never seen a pregnant woman slasher film.
No.
And Alice, the writer, director of the film, actually was pregnant, 7.5 months pregnant when she made
the
movie.
She was fantastic.
Yeah. No, she was fantastic.
She was amazing.
We're actually kind of in a receiving line to say hi to her. And talk to her for a few minutes. So hopefully we'll get an opportunity to do that. As we, you know, also consume free alcohol at this reception.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, CineFamily is one of my favorite places to come see movies. So, yeah.
I haven't been here in quite a few hours, or quite a few years.
Quite a few hours?
Yeah.
Did you say quite a few hours?
I'm tired.
Yeah. Well, let's see how that poll works out for you. First of all, love the film.
Yeah. Thanks.
And you were 7.5 months pregnant when you...
Yes, I was. I was 7.5 months pregnant. It was not a fake bump. It was real.
And you star in the film as well.
Yeah. Literally, a company came to me and said, do you want to develop something? And I was like, I can't because I'm pregnant. But, you know, I was really scared about taking time out as a freelancer. I was scared about taking time out as an actress. And, you know, someone asking me, do you want to develop a film? I was like, this is such a good opportunity. I should just do it. And I thought, well, if I was going to be in it and I'm pregnant, what could I write for myself as a pregnant character? And that was how the idea came about, really.
Was this an idea you had prior or just something you came up during those 2 weeks?
I was pregnant when I came up with that idea. Mm. So, I mean, I wouldn't have had the idea were I not pregnant. And were I not a bit frightened of about my career and about money and about my identity or whatever, you know, I wouldn't have come up with this had I not been already pregnant. And I'm fearing the future, basically.
Have you ever had any bad dates with DJs?
It's a good question. I feel like we've all met a DJ Dan. We've all had the misfortune to meet a DJ Dan. I mean, I kind of love him. I love all of the characters in the film. I know it seems like I hate them, but I love them. I love all the characters that I create. You know, they're like my children. And I have a fondness for DJ Dan. I think he's like that person that can't grow up, you know? And he has this kind of vanity that he is gorgeous and that he's a catch, and he's not. But, you know, it's probably his mum's fault that she's made him feel a bit too special. But yeah, I kind of love that character, really. But yeah, I think I've met a lot of comedians that are DJ Dan.
Where did the title come from?
Well, you know, it was just a joke, really. I sort of said, oh, it's about a pregnant woman who takes revenge. We'd call it Prevenge. And then I was like, we wouldn't call it that. We'd call it something much better than that. It's a terrible title. It's really schlocky and pulpy. And then it just stuck. It was like nothing else that we could come up with was as memorable. And I thought, do you know what? In this internet age, if you find something that is memorable and catches on, you just go with it, really. And even we had a sales agent advise us like, you know, it makes it seem like it's going to be quite a tacky film, and it's got some profundity to it and some, you know, interesting ideas. I think you could call it something else. But by that stage, I was like, nah, it's too late. This is what it is. And I do think it served us really well, that title, because it sticks in people's minds, I think. And it does what it says on the tin. You know, I don't really like anything, a title that's too pretentious. It's just you want to, you know, give people an idea. Throw them a bone, you know, about what the film's actually about.
But there are deeper layers to the movie. I mean, like, on the surface it might seem exploitative, but it really isn't.
Yeah, an exploitation film where I'm exploiting myself. I mean, I actually was, I guess. I was. I mean, that's the reality of it. I was like, what can I use? How can I get something out of this? So it is an exploitation film, but... yeah, I mean, sorry, what was the question?
Well, the movie's definitely smarter than, you know, most exploitation movies. Like, it's...
Okay, well, that's nice. That's a compliment, because I like exploitation films. But I guess, yeah, I mean, for me, it's always about, you know, you have your commercial idea, or you have your idea that you think people will latch onto, and then you want to smuggle in your clever stuff, which for me is the stuff that I get excited about. You know, I'm always trying to think about a bigger picture about, you know, I'm making a film about human beings. It's not just about women or pregnancy. It's about people. And there's lots of themes about society within the film. And this is all what keeps me interested in the project when I'm making it, is I need to feel like there is something that people could watch this in 20 years' time, that they'd find more stuff to think about in looking at it. So, I mean, you know, and that was true with Sightseers as well. I don't know if you've seen that film, but, you know, me and my co-writer, Steve Oram, like, on the surface, we've been commissioned to write a comedy, but for us, we were like, we want it to have a bit of depth to it, and we want it to have a bit of, you know, something that gives you more to get your teeth into when you rewatch it or whatever. And yeah, and a reason to come back to it, like in 20 years' time or something.
And as gory as it is, it's also really beautiful.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
That's a nice compliment. I mean, we had an incredible DOP who I'd worked with before, and I knew that he was capable of creating beauty in a very short amount of time. And I was really mean to him and said that you can't have any lights because I don't want to faff around relighting everything. So it has to be practical lighting. And yeah, it was a really lovely partnership that he... He also knows Cardiff really well, so when I was like, I want a Kubrick underpass. I want a tunnel that looks like something from a Kubrick film. And he was like, I know exactly the place. And, you know, I think it was a juggle, really. It was kind of like when you're making a low-budget thing. I mean, for me, always performances are the most important thing, but, you know, maybe second on your wish list is the visuals and having some kind of aspiration to get beauty on screen. And yeah, that was what I wanted to do. I'm very visual, and you know, people don't realize that sometimes because I'm an actress, and they think it's all. I'm a TV actress as well, so people think, oh, you know, you're probably all about dialogue or whatever. But for me, you know, I do drawings and I do storyboards and I do mood boards, and the visuals are really, really important. And it needs to have a mood. It needs to have a pervasive kind of flavor to it, I guess. And that's hard on a low budget, but it's not impossible. So, you know, everything about it was trying to create a sort of patchwork quilt of these textures that kind of belonged all in the same realm, in the same world, you know.
And also there are at least two actresses that I recognized from Game of Thrones. As a big Game of Thrones fan, like, how did you make that happen?
Well, I'm a big fan of Nina Gold, who is a casting agent, and she casts sightseers. And, you know, I always respect her taste because she discovers these people or she champions them or whatever. And I've long been a fan of Kate Dickey, but I didn't know if we'd be able to work with her. And the casting agent was actually Danny Jackson and he and Carlene Crawford, and they were like, we have a long-standing relationship with Kate, we think we could get her to be in the film. And I got in contact with her as well, and she was like, I love your work. And I was like, I love Red Road, it's one of the inspirations of the film, but I also, you know, followed you in everything you've done since Red Road. And yeah, so that was really lucky. Gemma, actually, I knew from the comedy circuit because she does live comedy, so you know, I was fingers crossed that she would take a leap of faith. Because, I mean, it's like a crazy pregnant woman phoning you up saying, will you be in my film? I would forgive anyone for thinking this is going to be a pile of dog shit, to be honest. You know, who knows what it's going to be like, you know. So all of these people took a leap of faith in being in the film. And some of them, I'd written them the roles. So I did have Gemma in mind when I was writing that role. I had Tom Davis in mind. I had Joe Hartley in mind. And to me, these are all people who are going to be massive because they are incredible. And I was like, I know that they're going to come in and they're going to really give me everything. You know, they're going to dedicate so much. And it was really about creating a depth of character in such a short time. I'm giving them a day to create the complexities and the believability of these characters. And if it didn't work, that scene would be rubbish, you know. So I was asking a lot of everyone that came in. Even though it's kind of episodic in nature, you don't necessarily see those characters again. But, you know, all of those scenes had to be amazing. They couldn't fail. They had to be, like... So we were just really lucky to get this amazing cast, basically.
And what's it like being here, you know, coming to the States, and you have written, directed, and having starred in this film? Like, you're like a one-woman show.
It's kind of crazy because I didn't really expect it to go this far. I also, like, it's this thing, like, when we did Sightseers, which was had a very limited kind of release in America, but, you know, it had quite a very successful festival run internationally, you know. But I had a co-writer, there was a director, there was several people who could be interviewed to talk about the film. And with this, it's just me. I'm carrying the promotion of the film. And I was like, oh, I didn't really think about that with a baby. So I'm kind of taking her everywhere with me. You know, and I'm still pinching myself, really, that it's all happening. I'm just trying to go with it. I think it's only like in, you know, 2 years' time I'll look back and go, that was pretty crazy. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you do take stock. Like, there's every now and then, like, just being at Cine Family, and I know about this cinema. I've known about it for years, and I'm, like, I'm here playing in LA, like, and this is pretty exciting. So every now and then you go, wow, this is really happening, you know. So all of that is really exciting. You know, it's such a low-budget film. I just kind of thought it might, if we were lucky, show at one festival, and if we were even luckier, might show on television somewhere. I didn't kind of think it would have this journey, really.
But now it's getting distribution, which is like every indie filmmaker's dream.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I mean, you know, sometimes I knew that it was going to get attention from a marketing press angle because of the story behind it. But then you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, but does that mean it's a crap film? Like, and then, you know, you have to kind of go, no, it wouldn't have gone this far if it had been a bad film. Like, you know, a story behind it can only take you so far, basically, of there being some kind of human interest or story behind it. And I think it's just like, yeah, the fact that people could watch it and not know that I was pregnant and just still think it was a good film. And that's like the ultimate compliment to me, because I don't want to always have to be pregnant when I make a feature film. I don't know how many decades of fertility necessarily I have left to kind of keep plowing on. It would be a very short career, you know. So, yeah, I'm hoping that people would be interested in what I do without me having to be pregnant while I do it.
Well, I have to say, I would never want to meet your character in Prevenge in real life, but Alice Lowe, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Fantastic
love
film.
Thank you. Let's get out of here.